Hello and welcome back to our digital class on physical chemistry of polymers, now with its third lesson unit entitled and themed Entropy Elasticity, also subtitled as Gaussian Coils and Boltzmann Springs. Before we get into the matter, I'd like to start with a little personal remark. You hear already that the sound quality has improved a lot compared to the first two lesson units. The reason is that eventually a good microphone that I have ordered quite some time ago already has finally arrived. We all find ourselves in a special situation at the moment due to the coronavirus pandemic, and that apparently also affects the delivery time of goods that we order, including that microphone here. But the waiting has been worth the patience, as I think the sound quality is really considerably better now. Yeah, I can take this opportunity to tell you a little about the recording conditions of these audio podcasts you're listening to. I just mentioned already that we all find ourselves in a special situation due to the coronavirus pandemic. That, of course, also includes me. And I'm one of these persons who is specifically affected by the circumstance that the child daycare, KITAS, are closed. Because I'm a lucky and honestly happy father of an almost 3-year-old daughter who, however, keeps me and my wife very busy and kind of at the edge of sanity during the daytimes. And so, as a consequence, the recording of these audio podcasts has to happen during the night times, and this usually takes quite some time. During the process of doing so, which I'm, by the way, not only doing for this lecture, but also for the Physical Chemistry of Polymers 2 and the Physical Chemistry 1 class, I have actually gained a lot of respect for professional podcasters or video bloggers even more, because I now reckoned what the hell of a workload that is. I actually find myself not in the bed before 2 a.m. in the morning in these times. I hope, though, that this is not hearable in these audio podcasts. Okay, after that little personal remark, let's get started with the matter. We usually do so with looking back to the previous lesson unit. I also want to do so in this present one. In the last lesson unit, we have considered simple chain models to describe average sizes of polymer coils. Today, we want to go beyond that and derive the full distribution of both the chain end-to-end distance in an ensemble of multiple chains and slash or in a time average view, even for a single chain, and also the distribution of the segmental density inside the coil. We will see that both will turn out to be Gaussian distributions, and so we refer to ideal chains also as Gaussian chains. The basis of this and also last lesson's consideration is the ideal chain model. Let's memorize again what the ideal chain model was about. This is very related to the ideal gas model that you know from elementary physical chemistry. In the ideal gas model, we assume the most simple state of matter imaginable, which is composed of point-like particles without any own volume and without interactions. And on this premise, a statistical theory, which is the kinetic theory of gases, delivers an equation of state for the ideal gas, which reads P is equal to nRT over V. Pressure is equal to the molar number of molecules times the universal constant times absolute temperature divided by volume. Very similar is the ideal chain model. In that framework, we imagine a polymer chain to be composed of point-like segments without any own volume and without interactions. In the last lesson unit, we have seen already that that consideration delivers us a scaling expression for the average size captured as the mean square end-to-end distance of a polymer chain, which is C infinity times N times L square, characteristic ratio times number of segments times the square of the length of each segment. Whereas the first term, the characteristic ratio, captures the chemical specificity of a given polymer at hand, the latter, the N times L square scaling term, is universal and applies to any, or in other words, all polymers. What we are lacking still is an equation of state for such an ideal chain, and this is what we'll come across in this lesson unit. And as we will see, it will be strikingly similar to the sister equation of state of the ideal gas. To get started, let's consider again the number example from the end of our last lesson unit. We considered polyethylene composed of 20,000 segments with a segmental length of 1.5 angstroms each and a characteristic ratio of 6.87 or 6.9. With that, we have calculated a root mean square end-to-end distance of 57 nanometers. Now let's estimate the volume that the monomeric segments occupy in that coil. We can easily estimate by taking the number of segments times the volume per segment, which we can simply estimate to be L cube. In this simplifying view, we imagine the segments to be little cubes, of which we have N, and if we didn't just take N times L cube, then we get the segmental volume. For comparison, we also estimate the volume that the entire coil has. that we can simply estimate as the volume of a sphere with a radius that corresponds to the root mean square end-to-end distance. So the volume of the coil is 4 over 3 pi r cubed. If we plug in the scaling law C infinity times n times L square for r square, this equation turns into 4 over 3 pi C infinity n L square with a power of 3 over 2. When we now calculate the ratio of the latter volume to the one before, meaning the ratio of the volume of the entire coil relative to the volume that the segments occupy in it, we end up with the equation that this is 4 times C infinity with a power of 3 over 2 times n with a power of 1 half. And if we plug in the 6.9 for C infinity and the 20,000 for n, this gives us a number that is larger than 10,000. This means the volume of the coil is more than 10,000 times larger than the volume of only the segments in it. That tells us that most of the volume inside of the polymer coil is actually empty and not occupied by the polymer chain material itself. One of the questions that we will address in this lesson is, how is the chain material distributed within that coil then? The answer to that question is given to you in figure number 23. There you see two radial segmental density profiles of the number of segments per cubed nanometer as a function of the spatial coordinate distance from the coil core. We see two datasets, one for a polyethylene chain with 20,000 segments, which we have just discussed in our numerical example, and another one for a polyethylene chain that consists of four times as many segments. This is the green curve. We see that both have the shape of a Gaussian bell. The segmental density is highest in the core of the coil and then drops as we go from the core to the rim in the form of a Gaussian bell curve. The mathematical expression of that Gaussian bell is given to you in equation 2.17 in our script. This Gaussian bell curve is broader for the 80,000 polymer as compared to the 20,000 polymer. It has higher values at its rim, which makes intuitively sense because that polymer is larger as it has four times as many segments, so it must of course occupy rim regions that the other one does not occupy. But it also has a lower segmental density in its core relative to the one composed of only 20,000 segments. That tells us that the larger the polymer is, the more is the material spread over the coil volume. Nevertheless, the numbers on the ordinate show us that the segmental density inside the coil is not overly high. Even where it is highest, that is, at the core, it has a value of about only 11 segments per cubed nanometer for the polyethylene chain composed of 20,000 segments, and only about 5 segments per cubed nanometer for the polyethylene chain composed of 80,000 segments. If we transform that into a commonly known molar concentration, the first one corresponds to about 20 moles per liter. This is not overly concentrated, and the values are even lower if we go from the core to the rim. That means the polymer coil is not a very dense object, but by contrast, a very fuzzy object. And the coil becomes even fuzzier as the number of segments increases. Don't be confused here. A polymer that consists of many segments has a higher degree of coiling, so is more coiled than one that is composed only of a few segments. That is expressed to you in equation 2.18 of our script. But this coiled object spreads larger distances and is rather fuzzy. In the following, we want to get an understanding where this distribution function comes from. That means we now go from average measures of the coil to the full distribution. For that purpose, we need a suitable mathematical approach. What can we use here? We have seen already in our last lesson unit that there is a surprising but very striking similarity between the scaling law of the ideal chain statistics, namely that its mean square end-to-end distance scales in proportion to the number of segments in the chain, and the Einstein-Smoluchowski law of a diffusing particle or molecule, according to which the mean square displacement of that diffusing object scales linearly with time. As surprising as this may be at the first view, as logical is it actually at a second view. The path of a diffusing molecule or particle is a random sequence of steps with random arbitrary angles between each step that has no memory, meaning it can cross itself. The same is the case for the shape of an ideal polymer chain, where each segment has a given length, just like the steps of the random walk of the diffusing particle also have, and the segments of the polymer coil can exhibit random angles between each other, just like the steps of the random walk can do. With that, the ideal coil shape can actually also be self-crossing, and that means hypothetically two monomer segments can actually occupy the same spot in space. This is why we name that model also sometimes the phantom chain model, as the monomer segments can penetrate through each other like phantoms can do. In the following, we make use of that conceptual relation and apply random walk statistics to appraise the distribution of end-to-end distances of a random coil. We start by considering the most simple case, which is the one-dimensional random walk, composed of n steps on an x-axis. This is shown to you as a schematic alongside equations 2.19 and the following ones in our script. We may imagine such a one-dimensional random walk as follows. We place some kind of marker at the zero point of the one-dimensional x-axis and then flip a coin. If the result of that coin flipping is heads, we move the marker up in the x-direction, whereas if the result of that coin flipping is tails, we move the marker down in the x-direction. That means after one flip, the marker can find itself either at plus or minus 1, with probability of 50% each. After two flips, the marker can either be back to 0, with a probability of 50%, or at a position of x being plus or minus 2, with a probability of 25% each. If we follow that line of thought further, we end up with the schematic tree diagram, shown to you in this context in the script. Alongside to this tree diagram, you find a table that shows you at what positions x the marker can be after a certain number of steps n, and with what relative probability statistics these occur. If you look at those numbers, there may be a bell ringing in your head. This pattern of numbers is nothing else than Pascal's number triangle, that you know from statistics, which makes sense because we're doing statistics at the moment here. The most probable outcome of the random walk is to find the marker back at zero. Positions apart from zero can also occur, but with dropping likelihood the further the distance is. And that dropping likelihood drops according to Pascal's number triangle. The reason is that for a given number of steps n, there is many different paths possible, each of which having the same likelihood. Many of those, however, lead us back to zero, whereas just few of those lead us to positions away from zero. Very few, namely just one respectively, lead us to the most extreme position away from zero, which is minus n or plus n. You may know an everyday life connection of what we learn here. If you find yourselves at a wine fest in Mainz and have enjoyed the wine a little too much and therefore conduct a random walk step sequence, and if you then tell your friends, "I'm going home now," and start your random walk sequence, with a high likelihood you will find yourself back at the place where you started some minutes after. This is not due to the temptation of the wine that you cannot resist, but it's dictated by physics. There is nothing you can do about it. We now have the aim to quantify these statistics. We start by appraising the number of walks that reach a position of interest x after n steps. This is given to you in equation 2.19 of our script. In the accompanying lecture textbook, Physical Chemistry of Polymers, a Conceptual Introduction, you can also find a conceptual explanation or justification of that equation that I would like to skip here. The total number of walks that we can take at all leading us to any position is 2 with the power of n. Together, as a result, both these equations deliver us the likelihood of reaching a position of interest x after n steps. This is given to you in equation 2.20 of our script. This equation is a rather frightening one, as it contains factorial terms. To get rid of these factorials, we can use Stirling's approximation, which turns the factorials into logarithms. To further get rid of those, we can expand these into a Taylor series expansion. That eventually turns equation 2.20 into equation 2.21a of our script. Our script outlines to you the details of that transformation. We will now transform this equation a little further by simplifying multiplying it with a factor of 1/2, thereby delivering equation 2.21b in our script. The reason is because if you have a look into the column x in the table next to the tree diagram above, you see that the integer distances of possible end locations of the random walk always have a spacing of 2. If we now just change the step length from 1 to 1/2, we end up with integer distances of the possible end locations by always 1 unit, which is more handy to calculate with further. So we just apply a factor of 1/2 to the equation. A quantity that we have worked with so far in our lecture was the mean square of the polymer chain end-to-end distance, which in the random walk corresponds to the mean square displacement. In general, in statistics, we get such expectation values from distribution functions by applying mathematical operators to them. This is something you know from quantum mechanics, where you apply an operator to wave functions to get expectation values, eigenwerte, for example, for the energy levels of the orbitals. In equation 2.22 of our script, we do so by applying the operator to our function that delivers us the mean square value, which consists of multiplying the function of interest by x square and integrating over it in the limits of minus infinity to plus infinity. That integral has a very simple solution. It's just n. As surprisingly simple this identity is, it is very useful because it connects the two variables n and x that we are handling with so far in our equation. That means we can replace one by the other in equation 2.21b of our script to obtain a formula that just has one variable left. we do so by focusing on the variable x and thereby obtain equation 2.23 of our script. This is the end result that we wanted to derive, an expression for the probability distribution of the one-dimensional random walk. Now, we want to move from one into three dimensions. How can we do that? We can do so by making use of a favorable circumstance, namely that our system is isotropic. We don't have any preferential direction in space. So that means we can construct a three-dimensional random walk simply as an overlay of three independent one-dimensional ones, one for the x, one for the y, and one for the z direction. This overlay is given to you in equation 2.24 of our script. As this three-dimensional random walk is multiplicative of its three components, its three-dimensional end-to-end distance is additive of its three components, as noted down in equation 2.25 of our script. With that, we get our desired equation for the three-dimensional random walk. It's given to you in equation 2.26 of our script. When you have a look into that equation, there may be again a bell ringing in your head. This is an equation that you hopefully know already from elementary physical chemistry. It's very similar to the velocity distribution of the kinetic theory of gases. That distribution has a form of a Gaussian bell curve as well, as it essentially reflects the Boltzmann distribution of the kinetic energies of the gas particles. So once more, we see the surprising similarity of ideal polymer chains with ideal gases here at this point. How will a graphical representation of equation 2.26 look like? Well, we have indicated that already. It will look like a Gaussian bell curve. It's shown to you as the green curve in figure 24, which visualizes the three-dimensional random walk type probability distribution of the end-to-end distance for the example of a polyethylene chain, again composed of 20,000 repeating units. What this curve shows is the probability to find a certain end-to-end vector, meaning a quantity with a certain length, r, and a certain direction, as given by the vector nature of that quantity, in our chain ensemble. In other words, that distribution reflects to us the probability of finding the second chain end in a very specific volume element at a distance and direction of the vector r from the origin if we place the first chain end in that very origin. This probability distribution is maximal at zero and then drops in the form of a Gaussian bell curve around that maximum. Why is it maximal at zero? Well, we have just seen, because the most probable random walk end-to-end distance is zero, whereas other, larger end-to-end distances have a lower number of occurrence in a sample. When we now ask for the probability to find such larger distances in a specific direction, that probability is of course lower than the one for zero. This Gaussian distribution of the end-to-end distance vector is very related also to the Gaussian distribution of the monomer segmental density inside our coil that was shown to you in figure 23 of our script. This makes perfect sense. The distribution that we have just derived is the one to find a certain end-to-end distance in one single coil. The sister distribution shown in figure 23 of our script shows to us how often this is encountered, namely how often we indeed find a certain segment of the chain in that very spot in space. As both follows Gaussian statistics, ideal coils are also referred to as Gaussian coils. In our consideration of polymer coils, what we are actually interested in is not so much the likelihood of finding a certain end-to-end vector, meaning finding the other chain end in a specific volume element in space if we place the first one in the origin, but more the likelihood of finding a certain end-to-end vector length, irrespective of its direction. This corresponds to the likelihood of finding the second chain end anywhere on a spherical circumference with radius r around the origin if we place the first chain end in that very origin. We can create that function very easily by just multiplying the Gaussian distribution from equation 2.26 with the spherical circumference 4 pi r square, which is denoted in equation 2.27 in our script. Again, something similar is known to you already from the kinetic theory of gases, where the distribution of velocity vectors in a gas sample turns into the distribution of velocity absolute values, which is known as the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, by the very same mathematical operation. You have also encountered something similar in a yet totally different field of physical chemistry, namely in quantum chemistry. In this branch of physical chemistry, you have learned about the shape and the wave function of the s orbital, for example, in a hydrogen atom. The square of that wave function, which is commonly graphically represented as the known spherical s orbital, expresses the likelihood of finding the electron in a certain point or volume element in space. This likelihood is maximal at zero distance from the nucleus and then drops when considering larger distances. Just as with the ideal polymer case treated here, in this problem, however, the directional dependence is not so much of interest for us. What is more interesting to us is an expression of the probability to find the electron anywhere at a distance r from the nucleus. And that we get by the very same mathematical operation, by multiplying the first wave function with a spherical circumference expression 4 pi r square. In figure 24, for the polymer, this is shown to you as the blue curve in the diagram. What we now have is a mathematical expression of the shape of a polymer coil, which is that of a Gaussian segmental density profile. In an alternative view, we also have a distribution of the likelihood of encountering certain sizes in a polymer coil over time or over ensemble average. From that microscopic structural information, we can easily get to macroscopic property information by deriving an expression for the most relevant state function in thermodynamics, which is the free energy of the ideal coil. How do we achieve that? We will make use of one of the most fundamental equations in statistical physics at all, the Boltzmann equation. According to Boltzmann's equation, the entropy of a given macroscopic state of a system is equal to Boltzmann's constant times the logarithm of the number of microscopic conformations or configurations by which that macrostate is realized. If we apply that to our end-to-end distance distribution, which is nothing else than the number and likelihood of microscopic conformational arrangements in which the coil can find itself, we obtain equation 2.28 of our script, denoting us the entropy of the ideal coil. This entropy is given as S is equal to S0 minus 3 kb r square over 2 times the mean square of r. In that equation, S0 is the entropy of the state in which we have an end-to-end distance of 0. And we see that the entropy of states with end-to-end distances larger than 0 is smaller than that, because we subtract a term with r square as the variable from S0. So plugging in any value for r different than 0 will reduce the overall quantity S. Conceptually, this mathematical identity reflects that the entropy is maximal at a chain end-to-end distance of r0. Again, this makes sense, because we saw from the random walk statistics that the probability of obtaining that very distance in a random walk coil is maximal, as shown to you by the green curve in figure 24. A little footnote in this context to the Boltzmann formula. I've said already that this equation is one of the most central ones in statistical physics, as it creates a very elementary bridge between microconfigurational states of a system and macroscopic properties, whereby the entropy is one of the most essential macroscopic properties that we can possibly think of in thermodynamics. It's core of the second law of thermodynamics, which tells us nothing less than an answer to the question of which states or processes are encountered and which are not encountered spontaneously. The Boltzmann formula also has a very tragic element. It is engraved on Boltzmann's tombstone on the Central Cemetery in Vienna. This has a reason. For Boltzmann, this formula indicated the heat death of the universe. What is that? We know from elementary thermodynamics that according to the second law, spontaneous processes only occur if the entropy of the universe increases. On a particulate level, increase of the entropy means a more random, disordered distribution of matter and energy. When following that line of thought, Boltzmann came to the conclusion that at some point, all matter and all energy in the universe must be fully randomly equally distributed, meaning the universe then has reached its entropy maximum. From that point on, however, no spontaneous processes can occur any longer. Also, no life can be maintained anymore, as, like Schrödinger once expressed in his book What is Life?, life feeds on negative entropy. In that, Boltzmann saw proven scientific evidence for the end of all things to come. This interpretation was conflicting heavily with the worldview of the 19th century in which Boltzmann acted, leading to heavy criticism about his theories, about his interpretations, and about his person. Eventually, this has led him to commit suicide. And as a result, the Boltzmann formula S is equal to K times LNW is engraved on his tombstone in Vienna. The great tragedy of that is, whereas the Boltzmann formula to Boltzmann himself indicated the end of all things, first of all, it caused his own end. Just to calm you down at that point, you don't have to worry too much because the heat death of the universe won't happen. There is a specificity of gravitational interaction that we must consider here. Matter that assembles by gravitational interactions actually heats up. This is the mechanism by which stars, solar systems, planets, and galaxies form in the universe, which was unknown to Boltzmann as it hadn't been discovered at his time. This elementary physical principle then does not lead to the heat death of the universe, but by contrast to formation of nebulae, stars, and planets, like our planet Earth. But as a little further personal footnote in this context, I foresee a potential different end of all things on this very planet. Not for the planet as a whole, but for one species living on it, which is man-made climate change. After all that philosophical discussion, let's get back to the core of our lesson unit. We now have a formula at hand that expresses to us the entropy of an ideal chain. From that, we can easily go further and formulate the free energy of an ideal chain, which is given to you in equation 2.29 of our script. We easily get to that expression because the internal energy of an ideal coil is independent of its end-to-end distance, as there is no interactions between its segments. And so only the entropy term minus Ts constitutes the free energy, and that we easily get from the entropy expression we already have. From that equation 2.29, we see that the free energy is minimal with a value of F0 at an end-to-end distance of 0 and is larger at larger end-to-end distances. Again, this reflects to us the favorability of having an end-to-end distance of 0 and the disfavorability of having larger end-to-end distances, which we again can trace back to our random walk result in which the end-to-end distance of 0 turned out to be the most likely one. From the free energy, we can even go further and obtain a very practical insight on properties of ideal chains, which is information about the force needed to deform a polymer chain. We get a force from the free energy if we just differentiate it to the spatial variable that denotes to us the direction in which the force acts. This is given to you in equation 2.30 of our script. Here we take the formula of the free energy from equation 2.29 and differentiate it with respect to R, thereby obtaining an equation for the force needed to stretch a polymer. We see that mathematically, this force expression is very similar to a formula that we know already from elementary physics, namely Hooke's law. It establishes a proportional relation of the force needed to stretch the polymer and the distance r by which we want to stretch it. The numerical factor that connects these two is a constant of proportionality that we can view as a spring constant. What we here have is a structure property relation. The force on the left-hand side of equation 2.30 is a property, whereas the spring constant on the right-hand side of equation 2.30 has to do with structure, in a sense that in its denominator, we have n times L square, which is structural information about the polymer coil. In the numerator of that spring constant, we find the variable T. What does this mean? This means that if we increase temperature, the spring constant has larger values, which in turn means that at higher temperature, it is harder to stretch the chain. That is surprising. Normally in mechanics, stretching materials is easier at higher temperature. They become softer as temperature increases. The ideal chain acts inversely. It becomes harder or stiffer as the temperature increases. How can we understand that? For that, we need a microscopic picture. And that we have at hand, as we have just thought about this quite a lot in the last lesson units. Let's recall our second lesson unit in that context. In its very beginning, we have made ourselves clear that the microscopic structure of a polymer chain is determined by three factors: the segmental length, the segmental bonding angle, and the segmental bond torsion angle. All these quantities can basically be distorted by applying mechanical force. Distorting the bond and the bonding angle, however, is hard. That costs a lot of energy. If we want to stretch a bond to larger bond distances, we must work against the positively overlapping orbitals of the atoms that constitute the bond, and that comes along with a huge energy penalty. We also do the same when we want to distort a bonding angle. However, as we have seen in our last lesson unit, changing the bond torsional angle, that means converting a local gauche or cis conformation into, let's say, a trans conformation, does not cost much energy. So that means, on a microscopic scale, stretching a polymer coil by applying external force is accommodated by that very mechanism. We rotate single bonds and turn them from local closed cis or gauche conformations into wider trans conformations. This is energetically easily possible, but entropically unfavorable, as we have also seen in the last lesson unit. It makes our coil more ordered. In the context of the random walk statistics we have just discussed in this lesson unit, we can now actually quantify this. When we transform a coil with a wild random mix of cis and trans conformations, which corresponds to one of these random walks leading back close to zero, which is a displacement having a high likelihood, and now we turn that into a random walk conformation that has many steps in the same direction, which in our chain corresponds to many trans conformations, thereby leading to a large end-to-end distance separation, which has a low likelihood in random walk statistics. This means there will be the arise of an entropy penalty when we do so, and that causes the back-driving force. That is the reason for the resistance against which we have to work when we want to stretch the coil. It's not so much energy, but entropy that we have to work against when stretching an idle chain. And that means the spring constant in the Hooke's law equation 230 is an entropic spring constant. And as such, of course, it increases with temperature. Because whenever we work against entropy, this will be more pronounced at high temperatures. In thermodynamics, entropy is always accompanied by its best friend T. You always have T delta S, never delta S alone. So entropy is more mad at us if we work against it at high temperature than it is if we do so at low temperature. The very same basic principle is also encountered in the entropic spring constant of equation 2.30. So far, this equation holds for a single chain. However, we can easily expand it to an ensemble of n chains just with some mind mathematics. If we want to calculate the total force needed to deform n chains, we just must take equation 230 n times. This will introduce an additional factor n into equation 2.30. To differentiate it from the n that's already in, let's write the n that accounts for the number of segments per chain as a large capital N, and the n that accounts for the number of chains in the sample as small non-capital N. When we now normalize that force to an area, we obtain a pressure or stress on the left side of the equation, whereas the length L that is already in the right-hand side of the equation will merge with that newly introduced area to a volume. And as a result, we obtain an equation of type pressure is equal to NKBT over volume, which is strikingly similar to the ideal gas law. So once more, we see the pronounced similarity between the physics of an ideal polymer chain and an ideal gas. In fact, the ideal gas is another system where we have an entropy-based elasticity, so to speak. If we reduce the volume of an ideal gas, we feel a resistance against that in terms of pressure that we have to work against. Why is that? The particles of an ideal gas don't have any interaction, so they should actually be careless about their mutual distance. Apparently, they're not. The reason is not energy, that doesn't even exist, so to speak, in an ideal gas, but entropy. When we reduce the volume of an ideal gas, we take away liberty for the molecules to arrange themselves in space. And that reduces entropy. We reduce the number of microscopic conformations for the system, and thereby, just according to Boltzmann's formula, reduce entropy. This is something that always makes nature mad at us, as according to the second law of thermodynamics, which is a fundamental principle in nature, entropy always doesn't want to decrease, but by contrast wants to increase, and so this causes a resistance, which we feel in terms of a pressure that we have to work against when trying to compress an ideal gas. The same is seen in the form of a rise of stress if we subject a polymer sample to deformation, here to stretching rather than compression. Just like for the ideal gas example, stretching the ideal chain will reduce its liberty to range itself by a certain number of microscopic arrangements to a state in which a lower number of microscopic arrangements realize a certain macroscopic end-to-end distance. The opposite case to both these examples are classical solid materials, like a wire of metal. This also exerts a resistance against stretching, but that resistance has energetic origin. Upon deformation by stretching, the atoms in the metal lattice are lifted out of their comfort zone positions in the minimum of the Lennard-Jones interaction potential to higher separations. That increases their potential energy as quantified by the Lennard-Jones potential, thereby causing an energetically based restoring force. This is what we refer to as energy elasticity, whereas the two former cases we refer to as entropy elasticity. To complete this comparison of boundary cases, let's also discuss the influence of temperature. For energy elastic materials, increase of temperature will lead to greater thermal activation of the atoms in that potential well of the Lennard-Jones potential, making it easier to lift them out of this. There is more energy of activation in the system, so to speak, to facilitate lifting out the atoms out of these potential well comfort zones of the Lennard-Jones potential to higher separations. Thereby, stretching a metal wire is easier at higher temperature than it is at low temperature. For the ideal gas and the ideal chain, as we have just seen, it's just opposite. The higher the temperature is, the harder it is to stretch the polymer, as expressed in equation 2.30 of our script, and the harder it is to compress a gas, as expressed simply by the ideal gas law. The change of volume of these different materials with temperature is different, though. We have seen already in our last lesson unit that the higher the temperature is, the lower is the ratio of the energy of activation over RT in the local conformation statistics, as captured in the RIS model, for example. That means increasing the temperature will favor a coiled conformation over an expanded conformation, and thereby an ideal chain that is under a certain finite load and therefore does not exhibit its most favorable end-to-end distance of zero will shrink to lower end-to-end distances if we increase the temperature. The bottom line of that is again that with increasing temperature, we empower entropy, which favors a more coiled conformation of the chain. The other entropy elastic example, the ideal gas, however, shows expansion with increasing temperature, just as reflected by the ideal gas law. And so does the energy elastic example of the metal wire. These materials also show thermal expansion upon increase of temperature, which in a microscopic picture is justified by clarifying to us that increasing temperature will cause the atoms to wiggle around more heavily in the potential energy well of the Lennard-Jones potential. But as that potential energy function is asymmetric, this comes along with a shift of the average of that wiggling to higher separations. All of which that I have just told you is visualized to you in a summarizing fashion in figure number 25 of our script. With the discussion we have just led, we came to one of the most relevant properties of polymers, which is their entropy-based elasticity. Their desire, so to speak, to have a messy coiled microconformation causes them to be able to store stretching energy. This is purely based on entropy. Energy is not relevant at all here, because energy has to do with interactions, which we don't even have in ideal chains. The way of how we got to the latter insight was a typical approach in physical chemistry. We have used the tool of mathematics, in this case statistics, to derive formulas, which then brought us conceptual model picture insight. The work that we had to do, though, was quite heavy. We needed some 10 minutes of mathematical derivation. There is an alternative way to get to the same insight much quicker. And this is based on a scaling discussion. It relies on a concept referred to as the blob concept, introduced by Rubinstein and Kolbe, who have illustratively described this in their textbook Polymer Physics, that actually traces back to Pierre-Gilles de Gennes. What we do in this concept is we renormalize our view of the chain. We don't conceive it as a sequence of n actual monomeric units with actual length L each, but of new conceptual units of size xi, each of which containing g of the n actual units. We choose that conceptual unit size xi such that up to that length scale, the thermal energy kBT is the most relevant energy. Any additional external energy, for example deformation energy that we apply upon stretching the chain, is smaller than kBT on scales lower than xi. That means inside these conceptual blobs, a potential external stretching energy is outweighed by the thermal noise kBT. At the very blob scale, an external deformation energy is of the same magnitude than the thermal noise kBT, and on scales larger than the blob scale, the deformation energy is larger than kBT and therefore becomes operative. That means, upon stretching such a conceptual chain by an external force F with an external energy capital F, the G segments inside the conceptual blob units are unaffected because the deformation energy inside these conceptual units is outweighed or screened by the ever-present thermal noise kBT. On larger length scales, by contrast, the external deformation is effective. That means the chain segments inside the blobs always obey ideal scaling, as expressed in equation 2.31 of our script. This is a variant form of the common scaling law R square is n times L square. We don't consider the whole chain of mean square size R square, but only subsections of mean square size xi square, which don't consist of n units, but of g units. On length scales above that scale xi, by contrast, we can conceive the stretched chain like a unidirectional linear sequence of these blobs, as illustrated in figure 26. Mathematically, this means that the stretched end-to-end distance Rx of our chain is simply the number of blobs times the size of each blob. The number of blobs is n over g, and the size of each blob is xi, so Rx is n over g times xi, as expressed in equation 2.32a of our script. replacing the g in the denominator of that equation by equation 231 transitions this into equation 232b of our script. And that can be further arranged to equation 2.32. Plugging that back into equation 2.33 delivers equation 2.34, which is an expression for the number of segments inside each blob. We see that as the deformation gets stronger, meaning at larger Rx, the blobs get smaller and contain fewer segments. So then, the external deformation energy is screened by KBT on smaller scales than it is in the case where the stretching is weaker. The clue element now lies in appraising the external stretching free energy simply to be incremented as KBT per blob. This is written in equation 2.35. The free energy of stretching in x direction is KBT times n over g, which is the number of blobs. Differentiating that by Rx leads us to force for stretching, as given in equation 2.36a of our script. We see that that expression is very similar to the one that we have received by the detailed random walk statistical calculation. It just differs by a numerical factor, but contains the same physical essence. We got to it, however, much quicker than by the lengthy statistical derivation we have done before. Another advantage of that form of the equation for stretching is that it makes us see some conceptual grounds. We may see such an insight by transforming it further into the variant form as written in equation 2.36b in our script, in which we recognize the stretching force to be KBT per blob size. All that simple scaling derivation of the same formulas that we have also obtained by other means in a much longer fashion is based on the premise that the chain has been renormalized and been reconceived as a new conceptual entity not composed of n actual segments of length L each, but of n over g new conceptual blob units of length C each. This renormalization of the chain shape is actually possible due to a very deep and fundamental property of polymer chains, which is their self-similarity and fractal nature. What is that? In very, very fundamental general, the relations between the mass and the characteristic size of any geometrical objects is expressed in the form of scaling laws. For example, if you think about a three-dimensional dense sphere, its mass scales with its size r cube. If you think about a two-dimensional thing, like a piece of paper, its mass scales to its size r square. Whereas if you think about a one-dimensional object, such as a piece of a wire, its mass scales with its length r with a power of just 1. In generalized form, we can say that the mass of an object scales with its size with a power of d, the geometrical dimension. This is expressed to you in equation 2.37 of our script. The same principle is also valid for ideal polymers. There we have seen the basic scaling law r scales with n with a power of 1/2. N is the number of segments. And as such, it is also proportional to the polymer mass, as that mass is simply the mass of each segment times the number of segments. That means we can also rewrite the scaling r is proportional to n with a power of 1/2 to r is proportional to m with a power of 1/2, and rearrange that to a variant form that m is proportional to r with a power of 2, meaning r square. Compared to the previous general perception, this means that a polymer coil has a dimension of 2. We refer to that as the fractal dimension, as it differs from the geometrical dimension, which is of course 3 for a polymer in our common three-dimensional world. Such fractal dimensions and the phenomenon of fractality is not limited to ideal polymer chains. Also real polymer chains show that. As we will see in our next lesson units, real polymer chains exhibit scaling of r with n with a power of nu, which we refer to as the Flory exponent, as denoted to you in equation 2.38 of our script. And that Flory exponent is nothing else than the inverse of the fractal dimension of polymers. Table 7 in our script compiles some fractal dimensions for various types of polymer architectures, both linear and branched. In physics and mathematics, it's a general principle that the smaller the fractal dimension of an object is, the less dense is that object. When looking into Table 7, for example, we see that the fractal dimension of an ideal polymer chain is 2, whereas the fractal dimension of a real polymer chain with short-range repulsive interactions between the monomer segments is 5 over 3, meaning less than 2. That means that real chains are less dense than ideal chains. And as we will see in our next lesson units, this is because the repulsive interactions between the monomer units cause expansion, swelling of the coil, which separates the monomer units from each other and thereby makes the coil larger and thereby decreases the segmental density inside the coil. In other words, makes the coil less dense. Objects that display such fractality also display another very deep and fundamental phenomenon, which is named self-similarity. This is illustrated to you in figure 27 of our script. Consider panel A first. It shows to you a square geometrical form with side length capital L and area capital A. And inside of that is shown a small subsection square of side length non-capital L and area non-capital A. Both exhibit the same scaling of their areas with a length, namely A is equal to L square, be it both written in capital or both written in non-capital form. That means when being shown such a square, we cannot say whether this is the whole object or just a small subsection of a greater whole object, because both have the same similar shape and both have the same similar scaling of properties as a function of measures. The shape of an ideal polymer coil that is shown to you in panel B of figure 27 is also self-similar. The shape of the whole object and the shape of just a subsection of it, as shown to you in a zoom-in view in that figure, is of the same basic appearance. Also, the scaling of the number of segments that constitute this object, which also corresponds to its mass, to the size of the object, is equal for both the object as a whole and subsections of it, at least in a statistical average. This is expressed to you for the object as a whole and for a subsection xi of it in the equation pair 239 of our script. If we combine these two equations, we obtain equation 2.40, which says nothing else than we can conceive our polymer coil of size r either as a sequence of n actual units with length l each or of a sequence of n over g new conceptual units of conceptual size xi each. This is nothing else than the blob picture that we have just applied to obtain an alternative derivation for the energy and force to stretch an ideal chain. Actually, we have encountered and used a similar renormalization of the chain earlier, namely in the Kuhn concept. In the Kuhn concept, we normalized the number and length of the actual segments that constitute a polymer coil to the characteristic ratio, thereby constructing a new conceptual chain not composed out of n actual segments of length L each, but of nk new conceptual segments of length lk each, the Kuhn segments. In the blob concept, we have done a very similar renormalization. This all is possible only because polymers are self-similar, and so their properties and scaling law relations that apply for them as a whole also apply for subunits of them, and thereby allowing subunits to summarize actual units and thereby become a new conceptual kind of unit. Mathematically, this also explains to us why scaling power laws are so frequent in polymer science. The only type of mathematical function with which such rescaling actually works is power laws, because power laws are not bound to natural length scales. They are actually length scale independent. Consider the fundamental scaling of the size of an object, being it a simple geometrical one or a polymer coil, to its mass, as we have just addressed when we started this self-similarity consideration. If we would be willing to test these equations, we would plug in values for test object, whereby we measure the length scale in meters and the mass scale in kilograms or grams. Somebody who has different measures, for example, somebody from the Anglo-American community who would measure lengths in, let's say, inches and masses in, let's say, pounds or ounces, would find the same relations confirmed as we would do with our units of meters and kilograms. This is because these power law scaling relations are universal and don't have inherent scales in them. In fact, the units of meters and inches or kilograms and pounds are just conventions. They are not fundamentally anchored in nature. They are, however, fundamentally anchored in many functions, such as rational functions or even transcendental functions like sine, exponent, or logarithm. In power laws, however, we are above that anchoring. And independent of in what unit we measure the mass, it will quadruple if we double the size of a two-dimensional object, for example. Self-similarity is a very, very deep fundamental phenomenon in nature. It's as deep as the phenomenon of symmetry. Many objects are self-similar, not only the shape of polymers, but also the surface of broccoli or asphalt, for example. when being shown a picture of those, you are actually not able to tell whether you look upon common everyday length scales like centimeters or electron micrograph pictures of these objects that display micrometer length scale to you. The same applies to the shape of coastlines, for example. When being shown the shape of a coastline, you cannot tell whether this has been extracted from a satellite picture, a helicopter picture, or a close-up of the sand grains that constitute a very, very local tidal section of the coastline. Ocean waves is another example. You all know the wavy surface of seawater when you sit inside a rubbery boat, and you probably also know the surface of the ocean seen from a plane window from 10 kilometers height. Both appear very similar, because we have wavelengths of different magnitude in the seawater. We have wavelengths in the centimeter range, that's the ones we see out of the rubbery boat, and we have wavelengths in the hundreds of meter range, that's the ones we don't see from the rubbery boat, but from the airplane. In all these examples, you would not be able to tell from a picture shown to you whether this picture is a close-up or a total view, because these objects have a self-similar appearance. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has been a very intense one, I admit. What we have learned today, however, is exactly what we seek for in physical chemistry of polymers. We have learned about one of the most fundamental structure-property relations in polymer physical chemistry, which is the entropy-based elasticity of polymers. It has its origin in the entropy-based desire of a polymer to adopt a messy, coiled shape. Any deformation that turns this messy, coiled shape in a less coiled and therefore less messy shape will come along with an entropy-based penalty or restoring force. And in fact, the mechanical properties, which very fundamentally rely on this entropy elasticity, have actually made polymers to be one of the most relevant material classes in materials engineering. What we have learned today is nothing less than the physical-chemical basis for that. I think this is worth the effort. I'd like to close this lesson with a little philosophical remark, actually. Along with our whole discussion that we have led today, between the lines, so to speak, we have shed an insightful view on the fundamental quantity of entropy, namely that entropy has to do with liberty or freedom. The common association to entropy that you may have received in former lectures is that entropy is disorder. This is, of course, somehow correct. I very much like a different viewpoint, namely that entropy is liberty. We have seen that today in a very illustrative fashion. A short end-to-end distance, which corresponds to a heavily coiled shape of the polymer, is realized by many different microconformations. In the random walk approach that we have taken today, it's realized by many different individual paths for the random walk. In the polymer coil, this corresponds to many different permutations of the same number of cis and trans local conformations along the chain. By contrast, a larger end-to-end distance, which corresponds to a decoiled shape of the polymer, is realized by only a few microscopic states, corresponding to a little number of random walks, because we enforce the condition to have more trans than cis in the coil. The first can be boiled down to a high degree of liberty, whereas the last can be boiled down to a low degree of liberty. As such, the philosophical bottom line summary of this lesson unit is that liberty drives behavior of polymer chains. This is very transferable to us humans. I very much hope that this very fundamental human right will always be given to you in your whole lives.